This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. It's time now for Money, Riches, and Wealth. Here's your host, Drew Tignanelli.
This is Drew Tignanelli here with Money, Riches, and Wealth. Tom, I've been taking voice lessons, trying to deepen my voice for the radio. It's going.
Yeah, it's great.
It's working well.
Yeah, it's quite interesting.
What do you think?
Yeah, well, people are gonna say, "Who is that on the radio?"
I've been admiring Sean's voice on the radio, and I've been taking voice lessons to try to deepen it and so sound more like him.
Yeah.
When I talk. Anyway, we're here. And we have a guest tonight, and in my opinion, it's probably one of the most important topics that anybody, you know, serious about their personal finances should be familiar with. So tell us who's on the line and what we're going to be talking about.
Yeah, well, we've got Andy Rothman from Matthews Asia. He's the investment strategist there, and he's principally responsible for research focused on China and all the economic and political developments that are going on. As well as, you know, a key role in communicating with clients there, the media. So he does, you know, things like this with us. He spent 14 years as CLSA's China macroeconomic strategist, conducting analysis into China. And very interesting, he spent 17 years in the U.S. Foreign Service with a diplomatic career focused on China, including as head of the macroeconomic.
It's not the French Foreign Legion.
No, it wasn't the French Foreign Legion. It was U.S. Foreign Service. But he's got his M.A. from Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs, B.A. from Colgate. He's proficient in Mandarin. I have trouble with English, and he's got Mandarin down. But he lived and worked in China for more than 20 years. So this is a man with boots on the ground.
Well, you know, we would conduct this conversation in Mandarin, but, you know, I don't think any of our listeners would understand what we're saying. So let's just do it in English. Andy, are you with us?
Hi, Drew. Tom, I'm ready to go in English.
All right, my friend. Hey, we appreciate you being with us. According to your resume, obviously, you are well qualified to talk with us about Asia and China specifically. But one of the reasons that we wanted to talk with Andy is because the group that he's with, Matthews Asia, is one of the only mutual fund groups that focuses solely on Asia.
Right.
And that's critical because... Yeah. In my opinion, Asia is the future of the economic world. The United States will always be powerful, but Asia is an emerging power. What's your thoughts toward Asia as a whole, Andy? Do you agree that that's really a place we got to be focused?
I think it's a place that every investor needs to spend a little bit of time on. Even if you just look at China, that's about a third of global economic growth right now. That's a bigger share of global economic growth than the U.S., Europe, and Japan combined. So even if you don't want to get into investing directly in Asia or China, you really need to know what's happening in that part of the world in order to better understand what's going to happen over in markets here.
So a lot of people are concerned, Andy, about China because of their one political party system. Sometimes I get jealous of a one political party system when I watch ours. But why should people not be or should be concerned about that?
Well, I think that's an important part of understanding what's going on in China. But maybe the first myth to dispel is it's not really a communist party, even though they call themselves that. In fact, I joke that after living in China for more than 20 years, a few years ago, I moved to Berkeley, California. And I think there's probably more people in my neighborhood there who believe in Marxist-Leninist theory than there are in all of Beijing. It is a one-party authoritarian regime, which has a lot of negative aspects to it. Those are obvious, so I won't go into them. But the positive side is that they've been pursuing economic policies for the last 20 years, which have been very pragmatic and designed to increase wealth for everybody and to move the economy more towards a market system. Let me give you just one example. When I started working in China 30 years ago, there were no private companies at all. You couldn't even find a privately owned restaurant. Today, more than 80% of employment in Chinese companies, all the new job creation in China is from small entrepreneurial companies just like here.
Really?
That's surprising.
And on top of that, we have to recognize that that has led to a boom in the consumer part of the economy there. So within a few years, retail spending in China is going to be bigger than the amount spent here. And I think the average Chinese person, in addition to getting a lot richer, income there adjusted for inflation is up 130% over the last decade compared to an 11% increase here over that time. But more importantly, they're becoming a lot more like us. They spend their money the ways we do. Their aspirations for themselves and for their kids are really similar to what we want here. And that's important. And that's why we focus at Matthews Asia on investing in the consumer and services part of that economy.
Now, you said something interesting there in that statement. You used the word plural kids. Not many Chinese actually have more than one child. I know that they changed that, but still they're not having more than one child. Is that trend starting to turn around?
I don't think that trend is going to change. So they put the one-child policy in effect in about 1980, and they've now lifted it. But like here, most Chinese people are opting to have smaller families for the same reasons that apply here. But it's still really important that they ended the one-child policy recently, because it means that the government is getting out of people's bedrooms. And it was really done for that reason. And I think the average Chinese person appreciates that now they can decide, even if they don't want to have two, they have the option to.
But they only can have two. They're still telling them how many they can have.
That's right. And as I said before, there are certainly a lot of downsides to having a one-party authoritarian regime. But I try to put this in context. The directional movement, the directional change in Chinese society is going in the right direction. Again, to go back to the early 1980s, when I started working in China, the government controlled everybody's life all day. They told you where to live, where to go to school, what to study, and they even controlled your ability to leave the country. Of course, there were no private sector jobs. Now all that's gone. You can pretty much do anything you want. Kids is one issue, and protesting against the government's another. That one you certainly still can't do. But for the majority of things that most of us care about, there's a tremendous degree of political freedom that didn't exist just a couple of decades ago.
All right, Andy, we have to take a pause and find out what's happening with traffic. But when we come back, we want to talk about Xi Jinping. And, you know, he's ended his first 5 years. Where do you think he's headed in the future? Do you think he's going to liberalize more, or is he going in an opposite direction? And then we're going to talk more about economics in China in the second half of the show. Right now, we're going to traffic. Be right back. Money, riches, and wealth.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
Talking about China, Chris. Great song, but we're talking about China. Come on. Come on, get with me now. Okay. We're here with Andy Rothman, and we're talking about China. So, hey, Andy, Xi Jinping, he's through his first 5 years. He's got five left, and I think I got that right?
That's right.
And, you know, he was liberalizing. It looked like he was going to be the great liberalizer as much as, what was his name, Deng, back in the 90s. What was the guy's name in the 80s and 90s that really...
Deng Xiaoping.
Yeah, I was close. you know, so he looked like he was really going to come in and make more big push forward to free markets. And now I'm not sure. I'm not sure which way he's going. Where is he going?
Well, I think part of the problem was that foreigners tended to wait for each new Chinese leader to come in with overly unrealistic expectations about how fast the reform process is going to go. So I think that over the last 20 years, the change has been phenomenal. I keep going back to saying that, you know, not that long ago, there were no private companies, and now they dominate the Chinese economy. But the change has generally been quite slow. There was only really one period in the mid-late 90s where they moved right quite rapidly, but that's tough to do again because put this in context. In the late 90s, over a six-year period, the Chinese government laid off 46 million workers, mostly from state companies and state agencies. That's a lot of people. That's like laying off the entire workforce of France and Italy in 6 years. They probably didn't want to have to do that again. So things are moving a lot more slowly now. Last year, they cut the size of the state sector by a couple of million people. The year before, about 5 million people. So, you know, they're also focused on continuing to have reasonable growth and stability, keeping people happy, just like here. So I think we all believe that they could probably go a little bit more quickly, but we also don't want them to do anything which would destabilize the second largest economy in the world.
So Trump is fighting and beating up on China, you know, this and that. In many ways, I think he's wrong, but in many ways, I can agree with him. I mean, you know, China doesn't give American companies a fair shake. They're constantly looking for ways to knock the guy out that's in there. You know, I was reading an article today about ballpoint pens. Mm. And, you know, the Chinese government is trying to look for a way to come up with their own ballpoint so they don't have to bring them in from France and so forth. Mm-hmm. And they're constantly doing these things to hurt international competition. Apple's fights, you know, constantly fighting with them. Facebook is constant. So there's a lot of things they do that doesn't create free trade. So where do you stand on this, and how do you see that affecting China? Is Trump right, Trump wrong? Is it in between, somewhere in the middle? How's it going to shake out?
Okay, well, I'm a bit more optimistic about this, Drew, because I think that there are a lot of American companies that have found a fantastic market in China. And, you know, even if they start moving on ballpoint pens, take a different approach to this. Boeing, over the last 5 years, has sold more airplanes to China than it sold in the United States. Ford and GM are selling millions of cars in China. Hollywood's doing a much better job of selling its movies there. The pharmaceuticals industry is selling a lot of drugs there. If you look at the latest survey that just came out from the American Chamber of Commerce in Beijing, the majority of American companies in that organization are reporting that they're profitable there and that they're going to be investing more. Here's another way to look at it. Since China joined the World Trade Organization, the WTO, 15 years ago, U.S. exports to China are up by more than 600%. Whereas our exports to the rest of the world are up by only 80%. Now, there are a lot of problems we have with protecting intellectual property rights, trademarks, and just market access and issues with government transparency. But we shouldn't overlook the fact that in a fairly short period of time, this has become a really good market for a lot of American companies.
Okay, but, you know, look at Alibaba, comes public, and you can't even buy Alibaba. You got to buy some phony baloney company out of Grenada or somewhere, out of, you know, Grand Bahamas or whatever, somewhere, you know. You're not even really buying Alibaba. You're buying some phony baloney, you know, accounting technique.
Well, it is an accounting technique, but the reason they've done that, and many other companies from other countries have done this as well, is to be able to list their stock in the United States rather than in China. So they've used something called an ADR, American Depository Receipt. And there are some technical risks to that, but we're pretty happy.
Alibaba is not an American Depository Receipt. It's some kind of company which has a contract with the Chinese company that says you're buying some revenue and profit of the company, and that's what you're buying. At least that's what it said when I read the initial public offering. I couldn't buy it. I can't buy it to the day.
Yeah, well, I think there are some technical issues that you highlight there, but in general, we're happy participating in listings like that, and we think that the risks are not that big.
Okay. You had some.
Now, you have other options, of course. You can buy you can own the majority of Chinese listed companies through their offerings in Hong Kong. Or if you work with a broker or a fund that has the ability to buy directly in the Chinese market, you can do that as well.
So that's the A shares, the B shares, and the C shares, and the S shares, and so forth. What are you going to say, Tom?
Yeah, Andy, so, you know, give us a little picture here, you know, China and the quality of the data that comes out. I mean, there's long time been concern about, you know, what are we really getting? Is the data any good? You know, the South China Post just the other day had an article, you know, and I can't even pronounce the name of the city, but the governor comes out of the city and saying, yeah, we're all fudging the numbers here. We've been doing that for years. And so, I mean, is it getting better? Is it worse? What's your take on that?
Yeah, that's a good question, Tom. I think that the data is definitely still problematic, but it's getting a lot better. And the key is having the experience to know which data points in China are pretty accurate and which are not. And I think that the other big distinction is that 25 years ago, the government was deliberately manipulating the data. And today they're not doing that with one exception, and that's the GDP growth rate, where they are smoothing it out. But my advice to people is don't pay any attention to China's GDP growth rate, because if you think about it, how important is the GDP growth rate to your investment decisions when you're trying to decide whether to buy a stock in the United States or a stock in Europe? Most people don't even know what the GDP number is in most cases. So for me, that's the least important statistic. The other important thing is that because most companies in China today and most of the economy is driven by small entrepreneurial private companies, we can get data from them without going through the government to double check whatever the government is telling us. And so I've got a pretty high degree of confidence now that I understand the direction and pace of the economy. Was GDP growth 6.7% last year or 6.2? I don't really care very much.
Mm-hmm. So two of the places,
my decisions.
Two of the places that I like to look at for what's really going on in China without looking at the official data is one is MatthewsAsia.com, mm-hmm. Synology. Mm-hmm. That's Andy's web blog, Synology, Sinology. And it's you can just Google Matthews Asia, Andy Rothman, mm-hmm. Synology, Sinology. I think I did that right. And the other one I like, Andy, is China Beige Book. You like China Beige Book?
Sure. That's another
Leland Miller.
Of it. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep. That's another good source. But let me give you a more granular way to break it out. Instead of looking at GDP growth, keep in mind that the Chinese economy has been rebalancing or restructuring a lot, and the consumer part of the economy is now the biggest part, just like here.
Much like ours,
and so one of the numbers I like to track is the growth rate of express package deliveries. That tells you what's happening with the online part of the economy, and that's grown at about 50% over the last couple of years.
Wow. Anyway, you know, we like China. We like it a lot. So, you know, don't get me wrong when we're asking some of these questions. We just want our listeners to hear what you have to say about China. But right now we have to take a pause, and we're going to start talking about, you know, the investment climate in China and what's the possibilities out there. But right now we have to find out what's going on in traffic. We're going to be right back with Andy Rothman. Take it away, traffic.
You need help organizing your financial life? You thought about what retirement looks like when you go beyond just the numbers? The Financial Physical is the first step in working together to organize your personal finances and your goals. This is Drew Tignanelli, host of Money, Riches, and Wealth, and president of the Financial Consulate, an independent, fee-only firm. Call today to schedule your Financial Physical and experience the difference. Learn at DrewTig.com. That's DrewTig.com. Or 410-823-SAVE. That's 410-823-SAVE.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
What is that, Chris? Just something. I have no idea.
You're gonna type it out for you there.
I guess.
Yeah. But it definitely sounded
David Bowie,
Asian.
China,
you know,
girl.
China girl.
There you go. See? Very good. Pretty cool.
Andy's going to realize that our musical knowledge is not all that great sometimes.
Mine is superb, Tom. Anyway, Andy, so, you know, we want to invest in China. There are three big things people are talking about that, you know, you keep hearing doomsday stories for China. One, let's do them one, and I'll tell you all three of them. First one is China debt. Second one is China's currency. Third one is military. So let's take them one at a time. China debt, is it a big problem? Are they a Ponzi scheme ready to implode?
It is a big problem, but the question is, what is that problem going to result in? And my view is it's going to result in more of what we've seen over the last decade, which is every year, every part of the Chinese economy grows just a little bit more slowly on a year-on-year basis. But that's still really fast compared to the rest of the world off of a very big base. The reason I don't think it's going to cause the crisis or collapse that a lot of people talk about is they don't have a financial system like ours. Almost every significant financial institution in China is controlled by the state, and the debt problem is primarily the result of what the Chinese did to try and shore up their economy during the global financial crisis about 10 years ago. So it was the state directing state-controlled banks to lend money to state-controlled companies to build state-designated public infrastructure projects like bridges and roads. Now, they're having to pay for that, but since there's no private participation there, they're not going to have the problem we had. Instead, they're simply going to see not a banking crisis, but the government's fiscal deficit to GDP ratio will go up, limiting over time how much money they can spend on things like schools and the environment.
Okay, so how about the currency? People are saying that they've manipulated their currency. You hear our current president keeps calling them a currency manipulator, and people think that if they ever let their currency actually be freely floating, that it would, you know, would plummet.
Mm. Well, you know, find me a country anywhere, including here, that doesn't somehow manipulate its currency. Everybody does that. The real question is, why are they doing it? If you go back to 2005, when they broke what we call the hard peg between the Chinese currency, the renminbi, and the dollar, their currencies actually appreciated, strengthened by about 45% against our currency. Now, last year, as you know, the dollar was really strong between election day and the end of the year. And as a result, most other currencies around the world fell a lot against the dollar. But the Chinese manipulated their currency to prevent it from falling as much. So they were actually manipulating it in our own interest here in the U.S. But the main point I'd make is the direction that the Chinese currency moves is right now being dictated by the strength or weakness of the U.S. dollar, not by anything going on in China. So far this year, the U.S. dollar has weakened a little bit, and the renminbi, the Chinese currency, is actually up about 1% against the dollar right now.
The last one, a lot of people are concerned about, you know, some of their what it seems to be aggressive nature in building islands in the, I guess that's
South China Sea.
And that there could be a confrontation with the U.S. or other countries there. You know, but the interesting thing about China is they've always been much more a defensive country than they've been an offensive country. And what they're doing in the South China Seas seem to be more like they want to build some form of defensive rather than offensive. But what is your take on that?
I think that's a good point. I am concerned about this. The Chinese government over the last few years has been a lot more aggressive in its own neighborhood than in the past. And that does make me worried, primarily worried about accidents. I don't think they're going to do anything like, let's say, Russia in the Crimea or Ukraine. I don't think they're going to go after any habited territory. Right now, they're building very small facilities on reefs and rocks and atolls in the South China and East China Seas. It's not good, but I think this is, as you say, about defensive, about marking their territory. And the other thing that's been good is that the U.S. Navy has been very firm in reminding the Chinese on a regular basis that we are going to preserve what we call our freedom of navigation, that our ships are going to continue to move through those international waters. And the Chinese response to that has been, okay, you know, we understand that's going to happen. Also keep in mind that the Chinese Navy is pretty weak, and they're pretty much limited to defending the territory right around their periphery.
So, Andy, neither Drew nor I have been to China. So, you know, paint a picture for us of the China people, the environment there. I mean, we have these pictures of pollution and crowded, and you know, but you know, are they all walking around with iPhones and Nike sneakers, and you know, do they want to be like Americans, or do they have some other vision altogether?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and I think it's one of the main sources of misunderstanding here is, you know, not enough of us get over there, and we don't understand how much things have changed. That, you know, I don't know if they want to be specifically like us, but they want to live a lifestyle like we have. And in many ways, they want to be like us. Drew mentioned Xi Jinping, the head of the Communist Party before. He sent his daughter to Harvard. The Chinese government has an exchange program with the Kennedy School at Harvard where they send their mid-level government officials. And, you know, most people in China would love their kids to go to high school and university here. And they're consuming, they're buying iPhones and cars. This is the biggest auto market in the planet right now. They're traveling. Tourism is just booming. So all the stuff that we went through as consumers over the last few decades, they're now experiencing over the last 5 years and increasingly becoming more like us. And I think, you know, they don't really want to fight with us. And I think there's no reason why we should come to that. So I hope that the Trump administration recognizes this and says, look, we've got a lot of problems with China, but these are problems that can be sorted out through negotiation and will not be made better by confrontation.
I was going to say, Andy, I'm looking at the second page of your most recent Synology. I think it's your most recent January 20th. And you talk about the average growth rate between 2013 and 2016. And the top four, online retail sales, 37.4%. SUV sales, 45.7%. As you pointed out earlier, express package delivery, 53.2%. Chinese tourists to Japan, 52.6%. So you know, you've really emphasized that, you know, that shift in the Chinese economy and the freedoms, I guess, that are going on that kind of look a lot like us, you know.
Yeah, and another way to look at that also is they've become really entrepreneurial. So the average Chinese firm is a small business of just a few people, just like the average firm in America. They've also become more like us in terms of owning their own home, kind of the American dream. 20 years ago, no one in urban China owned their own home. They weren't allowed to. Now, more than 80% of Chinese own their own home, a higher share than here. But one thing that they're not doing like us, they learned a lot from our housing crisis 10 years ago. So they're sticking with the old plain vanilla mortgages that we used to do here. Most people put 30% cash down. No ninja loans, no doc loans. So I think that the property market there is a real driver of the consumer story, a driver of the middle class, and also a great place to for us to look in terms of investing in the bigger and better quality real estate developers there.
Now, Andy, China's population is 1.3 billion, but if I understand it correctly, you know, all the great growth and all these buying of cars and things like that is really a limited amount of the, it's not the full population of 1.3 billion that's enjoying this kind of prosperity. Isn't there still a very large portion of the country that hasn't yet participated?
Well, I would say that almost everybody in China has participated in the sense that there's no longer very much grinding poverty there, that even people in rural China, their standard of living is dramatically better than it was 15 years ago, and their aspirations and hopes for their kids are much better. I'll give you an example. The Pew Global Attitude Survey, which is based out of D.C., their last study poll in China found that more than 80% of Chinese thought that their kids would be better off financially than they are, the parents. When Pew did that in the United States, I think it was only 30% who thought that was the case. So, yeah, the rural population, which is still almost half, can't afford to buy a car, but their life is a lot better than it used to be.
Well, we've got to take our last pause, and then we're going to come back, talk more about what's going on in China with Andy Rothman. But right now, we'll just find out what's happening on the roads. Traffic, take it away. I don't know what Chris is trying to tell us. Maybe they're landing on the islands in the South China Sea right now or something.
Yeah.
You know, but one of my favorite songs, though, nonetheless.
That's right.
And we're here with Andy Rothman. We're talking about China. So let's, Tom was saying at the break, you know, we got to bring it all around again. So why do we care? What's the purpose? What do you do Monday morning, as somebody used to say?
Right.
What do you do Monday morning with what we're talking about? So, Andy, the United States has a few hundred million people. We have a GDP of almost 20 trillion already. China has 1.3 billion people. They all seem like you were saying a second ago, they all seem like they just want to continue to get more and more prosperous. China probably, in many ways, many parts of the country, are still where the United States was in the 60s or 70s.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't bought their first car.
Right.
They haven't got their first refrigerator,
right,
or whatever. And you know, so as a serious investor, you don't have to necessarily focus solely on China,
mm-hmm,
but Asia's got to be a big part of what you're thinking about if you're a long-term investor. Yeah, yes or no?
Of course. And obviously, I'm biased working for an Asia-only investment manager, but there's a reason for that bias. I mean, that's the part of the world that's generating more than half of global economic growth. And so I think every investor needs to at least understand it because, you know, the media, with the exception of you guys, is always painting China, in particular in Asia, as just a problem. It's always going to crash or collapse. I guess people think that's a sexier story, gets more clicks. But, you know, it has an impact on everything. It has an impact on Apple's performance and GM's performance. Janet Yellen frequently mentions China when she talks about whether or not she's ready to raise rates. So understanding what's actually happening there, as opposed to what you're reading about in the general media, which is why we publish the Sinology pieces, is important. And then as an investor, the question is, you know, that's the part of the world that's generating most economic growth, do you want to have your portfolio to a certain extent directly exposed to that and benefit from that growth?
You know, Jim Rogers is a great long-term investor, been around since the 1960s, and he always says that Asia, especially China, is where the creditor nations are. In other words, the nations that are actually have the money to lend to the rest of the world. So who would you rather be with, the United States, who's $20 trillion in debt, or China, who has $3 trillion or so dollars of surplus money, or Japan, who has $1 trillion or $2 of surplus money? So I agree with you wholeheartedly. You know, China's an incredible opportunity. You got to be focused on it. You got to have something there. You got to be diversified.
Right. Now, Andy, I often ask folks, you know, that are investment managers like yourself, you know, what keeps you up at night? And in your Synology piece here, you talk about four things that are scary. You want to hit on those a little bit?
Yeah, those are all short-term things. And those are the four scary stories that I think are going to lead people to be a little bit afraid of China in the coming months. Two of them involve President Trump, the campaign pledges he's made to call China a currency manipulator and to raise tariffs. Both of these things, I think, will have much less of an impact on China if he does them than they will on the United States, unfortunately. Because one thing a lot of people have missed is that China is no longer an export-led economy. They're really being driven primarily by the consumer and services part of the economy, which is the biggest and fastest growing part, and by the way, also where 87% of our China investments are made in that part of the economy. The other scary story is that sometime soon, China's foreign exchange reserves will dip below $3 trillion, and a lot of the media will make a big deal about that. But my point is, it doesn't matter. It's an arbitrary number. China still has way more foreign exchange reserves than it needs. The second largest stock of any country is Japan at just over $1 trillion. So that's kind of a fake scare story. And then the last one is the property market. Sometime in the spring, new home sales in China will go negative on a year-on-year basis, but that's largely just because last year was such a hot year. Even if new home sales fall 10% in China this year, that means Chinese people will still buy 11 million new homes with a lot of cash down, and it's still going to be the second best year in the history of the Chinese housing market. So my point is that if you believe in the future of the Chinese economic story, the next few months, if people get really pessimistic about it, in part because of the Trump administration's approach, that might be a good entry point because valuations may come down. But I think by the summer, people will realize that these are short-term scary stories and not long-term ones.
Are the Chinese people still saving 50% of their earnings?
Well, that's the gross savings rate for the nation, which includes corporates and the government, but Chinese families are saving almost a quarter of their income. Let me give you a more concrete number. At the end of last year, household bank accounts in China grew by almost 10%. Here's another way to think about it. Household bank accounts in China, just households, families, their money in the bank, if you convert it to dollars, is greater than the combined GDPs of Russia, Brazil, India, and Italy. So that's one of the reasons why I think the consumer story there, the retail story there, has legs.
Do Chinese people get, you know, are they into credit cards yet? Or is that still something to come?
That's in its early days. Almost every urban Chinese over the age of 15 has a debit card. Credit cards are becoming a little bit more common, but most Chinese don't really use them the way we do. They don't use them as a credit card. They generally pay off the full balance at the end of the month. But it's certainly become a pretty cashless retail society, moving in that direction much more rapidly than we are.
So, Andy, tell our listeners as we wrap up, sort of, we're in the last 3 minutes, tell our listeners how they can follow more of your writings on China and so forth.
Well, thanks, Drew. If people are interested, they can go to the Matthews, with an S, MatthewsAsia.com website. And if you go down to the middle of the page, you'll see the a window for the Synology section. That's where my research about the Chinese economy lives. And then, of course, there's also lots more available there on the products that we offer for investors.
And I'd bet if they just Googled Andy Rothman, R-O-T-H-M-A-N, Synology, S-I-N-O, S-I-N-O-L-O-G-Y. I bet you if I did that quickly, I could get it.
You get it right if you did it fast.
S-I-N-O-L-O-G-O.
Yeah, it's important to put the Synology part in there or China. Otherwise, you get the Andy Rothman, who is the champion surfer.
Well, you're not that.
You don't do that, too?
You're not the same one?
I'd like to claim that. And on radio, I guess I can, because you can't tell what I look like.
I've seen you. I believe you could surf. So what other things do you want to, you know, share with people as to why they should be optimistic about China? You know, that you're ultimately optimistic that, you know, the U.S. and China will come to a deal. I mean, you know, Trump's all about making deals. So, you know, right now he's doing the talk tough stuff. But, you know, you think they'll make a deal.
Well, I hope so. I don't really know. Trump has surrounded himself with a few people who have been saying for a number of years that they think that the relationship we have with China is all putting us at a disadvantage. And I think that they're too focused on the part of the story, which is that imports from China and the rest of the world do cause job loss, a few million. But we also have to recognize that exports to China cause a similar number of new jobs to be created and supported, and that imports from China and the rest of the world are important to keeping consumer prices low. So I think we need to approach these issues with China, with Europe, with the rest of Asia in a constructive way and try and look to solve problems without approaching them in an aggressive and confrontational way.
I don't know that Trump can necessarily do that.
Yeah.
Do you?
Some of his generals are going to have to help him out there.
Well, it's going to be very interesting this week because General Mattis is on his way right now to Asia, to Korea and Japan, and we'll get a lot deeper understanding of how he's going to approach this over the coming days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, actually, Wilbur Ross, who's the Secretary of Commerce, is actually far more protectionist than probably Trump even is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he's interesting that he's been a businessman for many years.
Right.
Well, anyway, we're out of time. Andy, I can't thank you enough, you know, all that you provide to that we read that help us to understand Asia and China has been fantastic, and you've been an incredible resource for us. And so to have you tonight was a great honor.
Thank you.
Thanks, Drew and Tom. I enjoyed it.
I appreciate your time. Anyway, we're finished, and next week we're back to an open show,
yes,
right?
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. So we're over for tonight. This is Drew Tignanelli saying God bless.